Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in African American Studies. I am your host, Adam McNeil. Today we have on the podcast Dr. Gregory Pierrot, an associate professor of English at the University of Connecticut. He is on to discuss his new book, The Black Avengers in Atlantic Culture, published by our friends at the University of Georgia Press. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Most definitely, most definitely. And so, once again, thank you so much for coming on to the program. It's been a pleasure reading your book and learning about, you know, the Black Avenger, right? You know, we're in a time where, you know, it's a really, historically, it's obviously been an important trope, but with the last couple years in pop culture and such, it's really been I don't know if renaissance would be the right word, but it's something to say the least. So thank you for coming on. And so can you talk to us about how you came to this project?
Yes, it was sort of a long process, but I'm sure it will speak to other grad students that might be listening. And part of it is a really long arc. I'm French West Indian. My mother's from Martinique. I grew up in France, in a place where West Indian history is not really talked about very much, to put it mildly. So this was something I sort of discovered on my own in my teenage years and sort of got interested in. But as a major in American literature, this wasn't something I really expected to study as a grad student. But when I went to grad school, I took a class with Dr. Youngquist, shout out, in Black Romanticism. And for that class, I wrote a paper that ended up becoming an article, the first article I published in grad school. And it was about the representations of Toussaint Louverture in English news and media of the late 18th, early 19th century. Working on that project sort of led me to connect dots, let's say. I used to consider myself a 20th century literature person. It might not be obvious from the book. But so this is, working on this specific project sort of helped me connect certain dots and look at certain arcs and consider things I was very familiar with, movies and books and pop culture from the 60s and sort of look at them across a longer time period. And that's sort of when I started thinking about looking at just how far this figure that I started recognizing could reach, basically. So that's sort of how I got started.
Interesting. And so, I posted on Twitter last week about a roundtable from, I think it was at the Carji Woodson Center at UVA that was attended by you and Dr. Laurent Dubois and Marlena Dowd as well. I think that was
and Julia Gafford.
Yeah, and Julia Gafford, right. And so it was a really, a phenomenal. I was literally on the way to church, that Sunday, and so I was literally like reading, listening to the discussion my 55-minute drive to church. And so your discussion was really illuminating and really was a great segue for me from, you know, reading your book and listening to the discussion to our discussion here today. And so, you know, y'all were talking about the anniversary of Laurent's book that came out as well. Was it the 25th? What was the number?
15th.
Oh my God. Dating it. Yeah. Well, you know, it's probably a classic, so we'll add another 10 years to it. It's up for it too. But nevertheless, it was a great discussion. And so can you talk a bit about maybe that book's potential influence in your text too?
Yes. And this is a book, I believe I first read it right around when I started working on the article I mentioned. So it's called Adventures of the New World, and it's history of the Haitian Revolution. One of the things that I mentioned in the video, and I'm not going to rehearse the whole thing, but it is definitely one of the books that helped me connect those dots I mentioned. And I sort of joke about it in the video, but I mean it 100%. You know, the first time I saw that title, I couldn't help but think about, you know, Marvel's Avengers. I grew up reading comic books. And, you know, I sort of, you know, before I read it, I thought, you know, I was aware of the Haitian Revolution. I'd read C.L.R. James before. But I sort of started thinking, well, you know, well, what if the heroes of the Haitian Revolution were all superheroes? You know, I mean, you know, just as a sort of, you know, funny thought experiment. But then, you know, there was something of that anyway, right? I mean, I would argue that there is something of that in sort of heroic characterization of historical figures anyway. It can be more or less, you know, exaggerated, I guess. But I think, you know, most of the people who have, let's say, who are moved, let's say, by the Haitian Revolution, it's easy to fall back on that, right? To think of them in this sort of bigger than life way. And, you know, arguably there were, I mean, they did great things and against all odds. I mean, there's much to be said about this. But part of what I was also considering is, well, what does it say that we so easily, you know, turn regular people into superheroes, basically? The book itself, Laurent Dubois' book, doesn't quite go there. But it did help me consider what if there actually was a line between Marvel's, you know, Avengers and the Avengers of the New World, but what might that line be? And you know, I'm a literature scholar. It's a pretty historical book, but I really studied literature, so I thought of it in terms of narrative and tropes, and you know, what kind of how does one turn, you know, history into story?
And what you just talked about really is a great segue to my next question of what were the biggest challenges in writing your book? Because, you know, you just highlighted a bit just then about how, you know, as a literature scholar, you know, you're writing a lot of things that are genre bending, you know. And so can you talk to us about any potential challenges that you had while either constructing kind of like the not kind of not the thematic way, but more so the organizational way of your book as well?
I would say the biggest challenge, and this might sound a little silly maybe, but the biggest challenge I ended up facing was to decide how to cut the book. Because, you know, as might be clear from what I've said even now, if I had written the book I wanted to write, it would probably be, you know, 600-700 pages, I guess. Because really my original goal was to go all the way to the 20th, if not 21st century. Because it made sense to me, and there's much more to say about it. I stopped in 1915. It's a fairly symbolic year. It's the year of the U.S. invasion of Haiti. Is it the year of Reformation? I believe it is. It's right around then. But this the ridiculous thing is just how long it took me to finally come up with that time span. It literally took me over a year because I just, you know, I felt like, well, I'm not doing justice to my own ideas. And but then, you know, nothing else was manageable. So, I mean, this actually took me a long time. And I'm, you know, I still think about it. Maybe not every day, but at least once a week. So I don't know if that answers your question. That is the actual truth.
No, and you definitely answer the question well. And so it also makes me think a lot about, you know, your book is not only about, you know, the Black Avenger, but it's also, you know, what context is it constituted in, right? And so you're putting it into Atlantic culture, so the Atlantic world. And so can you talk to us about what are some of the foundational, you know, as a literature scholar, right? So what are the foundational texts to the Black Avenger trope?
So it's, that was another difficulty, of course, because, you know, as you know, because you've read the book, I start pretty far. I sort of present as a foundational figures, Lucretia and Spartacus, right? So we're talking about antiquity, obviously, but also a certain European culture. I mean, there are things that, you know, I could endlessly critique my book. Maybe I shouldn't, or maybe I won't. But, you know, there are flaws to, you know, I haven't looked into, African sources, or, you know, sources that might not relate with directly to European culture in that way. So, you know, that's something I don't quite do. I also, you know, I haven't found many texts. Not until later anyway, in Spanish. So I mostly look at English, American, French, and, you know, Caribbean texts. So, you know, that's one limit, I would say. But looking within that corpus, the line I draw is from English revenge drama from Elizabethan and Jacobean period. And so in those texts, I'm looking at several, some better known than others, but I'm really looking at certain figures that already keep coming back in early revenge drama, and those are Black villains. And it turns out there's quite a few of them. I would say maybe one of the better known ones is Aaron from Titus Andronicus. You know, it's Shakespeare, so I'm assuming people might be familiar with it. But this is a figure that we see, you know, in variations already, of, you know, quite often in drama, in revenge drama of the period. So what I do with the early text is that, you know, to me, the Black Avenger doesn't really show up until Afrobeth's Orinoco, a 1688 novella that many consider to be the first, you know, modern novel. But, you know, what I do is present this figure as really the sort of result of the confrontation of, you know, that revenge drama Black villain character that already existed, and the new circumstances brought about by England's involvement in the Atlantic slave trade. So if we're going to talk about texts, I'm really using a line of texts prior to the 17th century, and Orinoco as sort of the first real Black Avenger. And, you know, Orinoco is sort of used as a source for many things. What I hope the book shows is that even though, you know, I show him as a different kind of character, he's not really the first, right? He's the first in the new mode and modern mode, but he's also coming from a very long line of characterizations.
And you know, I had heard of Orinoco before, I believe, but it wasn't your book was the first one that made me think, all right, you know, it's been too long. You gotta go back to the 17th century and go read it. And I'm on the way to doing that. So thank you for the charge for that. It's interesting too, because I've with new books, I've typically done, you know, academic e-books and not, you know, novels, not novellas. And so, like, in the last couple weeks, I've really been, you know, excited about all the all the novels that I've just bought, because a lot of them are contemporary. And so they're within our, you know, time frame to be able to present them as new books to the listening audience. And I say that because I'm always interested in how novelists write histories, because in a way, for them to be hopefully somewhat historically accurate, they're basing it off of actual like primary source documents, or they've been reading secondary works. And so that's why I'm always interested in how writers generally get to their particular topics and to get to their get into their constructions of books as well. And so with Orinoco, what, you know, and you talked about Spartacus, and how does the Black Avenger within the context of slavery, right? Because this is, you know, the slave trade is, you know, bustling, you know, into this time and going into the 18th century. And so how does, you know, slavery, how does the slave trade, and how does, you know, I guess almost imagination play into your work too within this particular time frame?
It's a complex question.
You can break it down. You can break it down however you would like, okay. Of course.
One of the premises, I guess, of my argument is that these are very unique and new circumstances. And as much as people in the 17th century are familiar with enslavement, and you know, and it's historically and in the present. I have a strong belief that they're also fully aware of how different this is. And, you know, I might be going on a tangent here, but I'm sure you're familiar with, the sort of downplaying argument that always people always make about, you know, people being of their right time, et cetera, et cetera. I think the record shows fairly well that, you know, people in countries that practiced Atlantic slavery were fully aware of how profoundly immoral that was. And in this sense, you know, and I mean, also fully aware of how different that might be from other forms and prior forms of slavery. That's my opinion. And so the way I see it, the Black Avenger trope is sort of I call it an exorcism in some places. It serves two basic functions, right? It sort of makes slavery palatable in some way for the people reading it. It also exercises the sort of, and I really do mean this as borderline magic, right? You have clear awareness of the possibility of slave revolt. If anything, they know that's morally warranted. And I think the Black Avenger sort of allows to keep it at bay in some way, you know, through literature, right? So there are actual slave revolts, they know about them, but by sort of transcribing them into literature and also always failing them, right? Every, you know, early on, all those revolts are shown to fail. They sort of keep actual revolts at bay. I don't know if that makes sense. Culturally speaking, right? Of course, you know, it's not actual magic, right? This doesn't stop revolts. But by sort of like convincing yourself that this is the way it's going to go down, well, then you convince yourself that this is the way it's going to go down. And what happens then through this figure is that, you know, we get this thing, and this is a trope that, you know, again, I think it is useful for us in the 20th and 21st century, because we still hear this all the time, which is that, you know, only an extraordinary person would manage to even start a fight against slavery. But it would fail because this would be just one out of 10,000, and it would be one extraordinary person surrounded by mediocre people. And this is the exorcism, if that makes sense, right? You convince yourself that they can never pull it off, because even if you find that one guy, nobody will ever be worthy of him to follow him, right? And so to me, it's important because this is a sort of early cultural root for scientific racism, basically. I think it serves very clear, you know, sort of, you know, exorcist purposes, so to speak. But it also is one of the first steps to saying, well, these are inferior people, right? They're not quite human. And so it's really devious, it might seem, self-contradictory, because you have this main character who's always portrayed as very noble and sort of the most moral person you will ever meet, a very admirable person. And you can read this as a white person in England, you know, 17th century and feel for that person. But in the process, you also get to, like him, sort of scorn the people that weren't good enough for him. And those people are slaves.
Yeah, man. Now, it was, you know, you definitely broke that down incredibly. Because, you know, when I was reading your book, I just kept on going back to, you know, kind of like you said, like using magic and almost like the magical Negro in this context. Mm-hmm. And how specifically, you know, one of the bits that I think is important about your book and how it can be used, right? I think about your book in the context of like being in like a black masculinity in Atlantic culture kind of course. And mm-hmm. I say that because not only, you know, Atlantic culture is in your actual title, but how its uses and misuses. And if I may, I say this because if you don't mind, I'm going to read a little passage from your introduction that to me was one of the most profound, if you don't mind, of course.
Yeah,
so it's on page 12, and it's the last paragraph before your background. And it reads, Laura Doyle asserts that the Anglo-Saxon myth of freedom on display in Orinoco is the model by which later American myths of freedom, including African-American variations, were developed. I argue that, in fact, this myth was constructed as a prevention, a literary exorcism of sorts against the threat of a black nation. The narrator's citizenship comes about only to cancel out the possibility of citizenship for the enslaved, taking all of the novel's political ground and leaving none of it to the population whose political agency would most profoundly threaten the new American order. From Orinoco on, the silencing of the enslaved and their political agency is enabled specifically through the silencing of enslaved women. Ben's narrator raises Orinoco to a heroic pedestal and simultaneously unmans him, a piece of theater that deflects attention from a foundational phenomenon, the silencing of Amoinda. If this book offers a theatrical genealogy for the Black Avenger, it cannot do so without simultaneously excavating how the pattern of silencing and erasing Black femininity was built and normalized over four centuries in the crucible of the Atlantic, end quote. So that part to me was just like, whoa, like that not only the prose, of course, prose, like, dude, you got a real, real adept pen there. But also the analytical work about the pattern of silencing and erasing Black femininity. So as a way to move into a new section of our discussion, can you kind of talk about that particular passage and also, you know, the work that you're doing within it, talking about the silencing and erasing of Black femininity within the trope of the Black Avenger?
Yes. So this was a question I had asked myself when I was working on this, but that also other people asked me, where are the women? You know, are there women Avengers? Are there women in those texts? Early on, it felt as if I was derelict in my duty, right? Like, where did I not find those texts? But then, of course, this is a very, very masculine character. And so knowing this still did not quite, solve the issue, right? Just because there are no women there doesn't mean you shouldn't talk about it. That's obviously an issue, or at least part of the problem that must be discussed. And I think it's, one and the same thing. As a tangent, one of the striking texts that I thought was interesting, I could not discuss because it's from the 1980s, is Death Arose by Shirley Ann Williams. This would be the most obvious example of a female Black Avenger in a way that I could find. And interestingly enough, part of what she does in the novel is riffing of, the accounts of the Confessions of Nat Turner and other better known texts about, male Avengers. Very different things happen also in the novel, right? People don't die the same way. people don't kill or get revenge the same way, it turns out. And that's something about, you know, the very idea of revenge and the way it tends to play out with masculine, very masculine characters, like we've mentioned, that sort of forecloses conversations. You know, it's always the same thing, if you will. It's very historical, it's very heroic, it's all about war and killing and suffering, and it says absolutely nothing about what people do most of the time, which is to live and survive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the question then became, well, what of those people in those texts? Where are they? They're, you know, often scorned, as I mentioned earlier, right? People who choose life over war are, you know, by those very characters sort of looked down on. But then there are also female characters that very routinely are reduced to being silent and sort of standing around and serving as a pretext, and quite literally, right? Very often, what you see a pattern of revenge being directly connected to the assault and rape of these women who are not even allowed, in most of those texts I'm looking at, not even allowed to speak about their own assault. So, you know, I'm sort of all over the place here, but, you know, I sort of try to think and consider how those two patterns crisscross and are really, you know, part, you know, they're not separate patterns, right? They really are the same thing, or at least participate in the same sort of trends of characterization. Like there's no, you know, extreme masculinity like this without, you know, saying something about the place of not femininity, the place of women in the world you're creating.
And like I said, like that part to me was just so, so interesting. And what you just did just there as well, you know, just highlighting, you know, kind of like what your thoughts were about this process, because I'm always interested in like process. How do people, you know, get to the particular conclusions and interrogations that they do? And actually, I mentioned this to you offline as a question that was, you know, a very much impromptu one from our discussion prior to, you know, hitting the live bit on the button. You know, because what you just brought up was a great segue to something that's happening in culture today, and that's, you know, Harriet Tubman. And like I said, I think I was going to do this mm-hmm. a little later, but, you know, as the spirit moves you, as they say, and the spirit definitely moved us in that direction. And so can you talk about a bit, what maybe would your book, you know, or maybe a 20th century version of your book, 21st century, kind of look at in the context of someone like Harriet Tubman, who, you know, her actions, you know, within the greater trope of a black Avenger trope and figure. So because I thought that was an interesting thing that happened as well. And for those who might not be aware, there's going to be a new Harriet Tubman biopic coming out November 1st of 2019.
Mm-hmm. So if we look at the historical record, I think we know in some cases, we have names in some cases, but it's just, you know, even from what actually is on the record, we know that women were involved in every single, you know, slave revolt and revolutionary movement in the Americas. You know, this should not come as a surprise, but it might come as a surprise if we actually read a historical record without an eye for this, because they're never or very rarely mentioned by name, right? They're sort of there in the background. And this, again, is why I find, you know, cultural patterns interesting, because they bleed out from literature into history writing and vice versa, and they sort of, you know, feed themselves, right? So if you never see women, you'll never see women, and you'll never talk about women, and so on and so forth. And so, you know, when, as it relates to I find to be essentially, you know, a narrative trope, right? I don't think the Black Avenger is actually real. It is, you know, it is the way we tell certain stories. I think, you know, there's a reason we never see women or rarely see women in that position, and that reason is both good and bad. The good reason is because I think if you were to speak of what women do in these situations, you would have to speak about something else than masculinity, quite simply. That may sound tautological, but there is something about the Black Avenger that I think is essentially masculine, is meant to be that way. I've only seen the trailer, and I think you've seen it too. There's much about the trailer that it evokes every other, similar movie you've seen. You know, that a lot of close-ups on Harriet Tubman, holding a gun and shooting and doing military things as well. And she did in real life. But there's something about the way this is presented, right? She's going to be an action hero. I don't know if I'm being very clear here. We know what she did in real life, but I'm really speaking about representation here, right? There's something about making her out to be in a certain way that is bound to evoke a history of, representation of women in movies. We're not talking about historical truth here so much as a certain way of representing it. So to speak back to what I think was your original question, this is something we see in earnest in the 20th century. It's not that you don't see it earlier, but that I think it becomes a very self-conscious thing with feminist, revisionism of the record, quite simply. People have to actively go and look for women to find them. They were always there, but then you have to make that effort because they were there, but then sort of, as I mentioned, in relation with the Black Avenger, they were sort of silenced. And so in the process of making them speak, I think what we see a lot is sort of speaking against certain tropes, either by sort of recuperating them or, inverting them or, but speaking directly to those cultural tropes. And what I think, when I mentioned Death of Rose earlier and other texts, or you can think of even blaxploitation movies, right? What we see often are sort of a feminized version of a very similar trope to what we've been seeing. Death of Rose, I think, does very different things, but it sort of starts that way, right? I think personally, what I'd be also interested in, and that Death of Rose does ultimately, what might we be talking about if that figure was not going for all the things we usually expect for victory on the battlefield and killing, but really for, what would an Avenger look like that actually is there for survival and life, rather than, immediate sort of, military, victory, if that makes sense. And so what I'm hoping to see and what I think would happen with that corpus are, alternatives that we might not recognize immediately as vengeance, right? And probably should not. But, that's sort of another long conversation, what's covered under that term, I guess.
Right. And as well, to transition back to, I would say, probably the most well-known form of Black Avengerism, and that's the Haitian Revolution. So can you talk to us a bit about the transition, right? How did European writers, right? How did the Haitian Revolution change how they thought, right? Transitioning from, the late 18th century into the 19th, what role did the Haitian Revolution play in not only how they were changed by their thoughts about Black Avengerism, and also specifically speaking to how, how Haitians themselves, or folks from Saint-Domingue, their transition to being Haitians, how did they personally grapple with the Black Avenger trope?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to try to take this in order.
Of course.
I would say for European European American writers and thinkers, there's a very famous quote at this point. Everybody sort of refers to Michel Rolfe Trouillot in Silencing the Past, says, that the revolution was unthinkable to Europeans. And, we've all glossed this, who are writing about the Haitian Revolution. I think it's clear in the book that what he means is that it's not that they didn't expect a revolt or anything, is that they and the way I understand it anyway, is that they did not expect, or had been, you know, so used to that cultural frame that I mentioned, that they did not expect actual politics, if that makes sense, right? Revolt, revenge, they were ready for it. But that this would be, you know, so articulate, and I use that word purposefully here, was not what they expected, let's say. This was organized. This was, you know, these were people. And so what I think you see around, you know, European treatment of the Haitian Revolution is sort of bewilderment at what's actually happening. But the way they render it is the same way they always rendered that topic. So immediately those same frames are sort of, you know, the revolution is force-fitted into the same old frames. So they need to find the avenger. And so it's Toussaint Louverture. And so it's Dessalines. And so, you know, they sort of pull figures that, you know, they're there, right? They are military leaders. They're not made up. But they're made to be, I think, maybe not more important than they were, but they, you know, everything becomes about them in the same old way everything was always about the extraordinary person, right? And so in this way, somewhat maybe, you know, paradoxically, I think the Haitian Revolution changes everything, but it changes nothing. I don't think it fundamentally changes the way Europeans write about a Black Revolt. If anything, I think it tells them just how crucial it is you know, this may sound like a giant conspiracy. I don't think, you know, Europeans get together at night and discuss this. But I think what we see happening is that they double down on it. And at this point, again, it sort of merges with a trends in scientific racism that sort of reassert the same thing they've always been saying, right? For Black people in New Americas to do politics is only possible if, you know, someone who's very, very, very special and basically a honorary white person to lead them, because as a group, they can't do it. Now, the Haitian Revolution just demonstrated the opposite, but the discourse remains the same. So, you know, to talk about European Americans and Europeans and European Americans, I don't think it fundamentally changes the way they discuss those topics. Now, if we talk about people of the African diaspora, I think we see more interesting things. And in the book, I speak notably about the way Louverture and Dessalines themselves sort of played with that trope. And later on, I talk about Martin Delaney and his own take on the trope. I think, and you know, in the examples I used anyway, you know, the issue of literacy, and you know, again, I talk about being articulate, just with all the sort of baggage this term comes with. When Toussaint Louverture, when Jean-Jacques Dessalines use the trope, they are very, very much speaking to Europeans. And, you know, they're sort of riffing on it. They're sort of, you know, sampling and remixing, if you will. But this is not, I don't think they need that trope to speak to people in Haiti. They don't need to, because they're the people who actually did the revolution. I don't know if that makes sense where I'm going with this.
No, I understand.
You know, right. One of the ways, you know, this is used during the Haitian Revolution, just to go very quickly here. Europeans sort of start saying very early that Toussaint Louverture basically got his ideas from French philosophers. And, you know, I just want to pause here for a second to imagine the hubris of thinking that slaves need European philosophers to conceive of freedom. Right? It's insane. And yet, this is a story, right? And that is used to this day. You know, you will find most accounts of Toussaint Louverture's life, and I can guarantee you that they will bring up the fact that apparently he read Renal, and this is how he came up, you know, to think about freedom. Well, you know, it's this. You know, the only reason we still discuss this, I would say, and still take it seriously, is quite literally because it is written, right? It's in print. And so it feeds print culture. Part of, you know, to go back to your question, when we're talking about people of the African diaspora dealing with this, they quite, I expect, not strictly maybe deal with it in print, but I think this is where you find it. Partly because, of course, if it's oral, you won't necessarily find records of it. But I also think quite deeply that because they don't need it, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So you don't need this guy actually to make a revolution, it turns out. So I would say, to me, that's one fundamental difference. And when you see people, you know, the African diaspora dealing with this, you see them sort of navigating this either because they know they're speaking directly to Europeans or because they feel like they need, if they, you know, if they're going to write, even for Black readers, they need to tweak it.
Right? And it's interesting as well because, you know, how the Haitian Revolution has been used by people of so many different various allegiances, ideologies, political representations. It to me is just always fascinating, not only learning more and more about you know, Haitian studies and the history of, you know, like the founding years, I guess. I don't know if that's the right term to use, formulating Haiti into being. It's just really interesting to continuously learn about how people, you know, like David Walker and how folks like Martin Delaney and Henry Highland Garnett and even Charlotte Fortin, who was teaching folks, who was teaching children on the Sea Islands in the 1860s during the Civil War, teaching, you know, formerly enslaved children about, you know, Toussaint Louverture, like that, and, mm-hmm. and seeing the different contexts. But then you also kind of see the trope of the Black Avenger, you know, go into American freedom in the 1860s and 70s with the Buffalo Soldiers. And that actually is a segue into mm-hmm. the final part of, you know, my question period, in that I found one of the most interesting and really thought-provoking areas was the Black Avenger in U.S. Empire. And so can you talk to us about how the Black Avenger was included into the U.S. Empire?
Mm-hmm. You know, my comments earlier might have sounded a little ahistorical. You know, these things change throughout the years, right? And so I was really speaking in the immediate aftermath of the Haitian Revolution and, you know, up until the Civil War, basically. But, you know, part of what I tried to show when we look at the postbellum era and early Jim Crow era, and, you know, what some would consider the early years of, you know, what we call now African American literature, we have, you know, the same existential issue, right? How can one be Black in the U.S.? It's, you know, the terms have changed, but it's the same question. And you don't see as much, there's still discourse of, you know, immigration or maybe living in certain areas, etc. But for the most part, it is about, you know, being Black within these boundaries and in what way and what that might mean. And so I look at texts that are not necessarily very well known, even by literary writer, literary scholars, from the 1890s and early 20th century, where you see a very similar figure and very Americanized, right? At that point, you can see how the Black Avenger in those texts, I'm thinking about Imperium and Imperial by Sutton Griggs, which is fairly well known at this point, and as we see it by, and I always forget his name, Waring, I forget his first name, I want to call him Fred, Robert mm-hmm. Louis Waring, who, you know, developed, you know, Waring in particular develops a version of the Black Avenger that is basically, you know, the Avenger of the Western. And so he sort of, you know, reclaims Americanness and that is Imperial Americanness by, you know, shooting, you know, the Black Avenger tradition into what are at that point very popular American tropes. And in this way, you what I argue that he is trying to do is sort of create a place for Black people within American imperialism, right? So this is after the War of 1898 against Spain. This is at a time when he indirectly, and then other, you know, Black political figures of the time much more outwardly, claim that they can be agents for that mission, right? As Black people, maybe they are as exceptional as Americans think they are, and they can be exceptional before the Black world, right? So they sort of, they do not question separation so much as endorse it with a form of Black pride, if that makes sense. And so their recycling of the Black Avenger figure serves that purpose. They sort of take a very aggressive stance on separation, right? Some of those texts sort of imagine an America where some of the states would be reserved for African Americans. And so they would not be out of the U.S. They would be sort of, you know, part of the U.S., but just it would be the Black U.S., right? And things would be okay. They could do what Americans do, but for, you know, the Black population of the earth, basically. I mean, I'm sort of summarizing widely here, but it came as kind of a shock to me, but I believe that is a very strong trend at that time, which is, you know, sort of accept what they feel cannot necessarily be changed fundamentally. You see a lot of, you know, that a lot of the race science of the time has actually, if not been accepted, but somewhat made its way into global culture, including for those authors, right? So they don't believe in Black inferiority, but they believe in the separation of races. And so you see them navigate those issues partly by way of the Black Avenger trope, sort of, you know, again, recycled, right? I say recycled because, you know, you mentioned earlier on how, you know, movies lately have sort of, we've seen this figure come back. It comes back regularly, right? The dips and times when we don't see Black Avengers as much, and then they come back. I think we're in a time where we're going to see quite a few of them come back again. This was one of the peaks, I guess. The last one I look at, and which I think is actually involved also, culturally speaking, again, in, you know, the U.S. invasion of Haiti in 1950.
And with that too, to you know, and you had broached this in your conclusion. Can you talk to us about, you know, maybe your particular thoughts or maybe hypothesis of why now, why and you talk about the upticks and the downward spirals. So what would you think? Kind of, I guess, put your cultural critic hat on. What do you think about this particular time has been formative is not the right word, but why now in the 2010s would you say have we seen so many of Black Avenger styled films?
I think it's partly, if not entirely, due to the overall political climate. You know, there's something interesting. I mean, we had Black Lives Matter before, you know, the white supremacist offensive became very clear. But the truth is, I think those two things are not separate, right? I was reading recently something somebody was writing about novels from the late 60s, you know, The Spook who Sat by the Door, that was also turned into a movie, a Sam Greenlee novel, John A. Williams's Sons of Darkness, Sons of Light, that's one of my favorite, I was the one talking about that one, Chester Hines' Plan B, you know, all novels of, you know, that were all written within 3 years of each other, late 60s, you know, during the Black Power movement, and every single one considers the possibility of a black revolution in the U.S. Every single one, also the maybe not Plan B. No, I think Plan B as well. Starts with a scene that will sound familiar to every single one of us: a young Black man is shot by a cop for no reason, and this is, you know, the straw that breaks the camel's back. Right, something happens. You know, I'm not gonna spoil the plots of those novels for people who might want to read them, and they should. But, you know, they all look at the same thing. Now, we've all seen those things a lot lately. And I think maybe that's also part of it, right? Not so much that this is new, but that we've got to see those things in a new way. And crassly, quite literally, through YouTube, through videos, right? Things that we knew existed or maybe easily forgot existed, and that for the past, you know, decade or so have been thrust in our faces in ways that are, you know, relatively novel. I think, you know, I don't want to, you know, diagnose this. I think all those things participate in the same movement. I think, you know, the coming, you know, the sort of return of the Black Avenger, I think might be related to this as well, right? Culturally speaking, we have, you know, maybe, you know, I hesitate to call it entirely new, but there's something slightly novel. Again, that might be a crass word to use here, but about the way we consider those things. I think a lot of us are aware that these are trends that are, you know, hundreds of years old at this point. You know, this is not new, but the novelty of the way we get to it, I think, creates its own, at least participates in creating its own new cultural wave. So I think those things are related and might explain part of why we're seeing a return of the Black Avenger.
And it's a very interesting time indeed, right? So you can talk about Django, you can talk about Birth of a Nation, you can talk about Black Panther, you know, and you know, the list goes on. Oh, and I was going to say, and Harriet Tubman, you know, to add to the list as well. And right. And that one is in the second to last month of the decade too, right? So like you can really literally see from like, you know, start to finish really too. And so in the short amount of time that we have left with you, can you talk to us a bit about, right? So we know, you know, your book just got published and everything, but, you know, us at the New Books in African American Studies podcast channel, you know, we get a little greedy sometimes. We want to know when we can bring our authors back on to be able to, you know, publicize their work. So is there anything that you're cooking up for us to be fed in the next couple years?
So I can speak about, I think I'm allowed to speak about the big project I was part of that we just recently finally turned in to editors. This is a huge anthology of Haitian revolutionary fiction ran by Marlena Dout, and I'm a co-editor along with Marion Rohrleitner. And so it's going to be a very big volume looking at all sorts of fiction from all over the place about the Haitian Revolution. So this is really exciting. I'm really excited about this. As for more personal projects, I have to say I'm taking it a little bit easy for now, but I do have ideas. Two mm-hmm. of them being, and they're really in early stages. One of them I'm very interested in looking at Black Freemasonry, but here also internationally. And this might sound, you know, to go without saying, but from a lot of what I've seen tends to look at Freemasonry within national boundaries, right? So we know a lot about Prince Hall Masons. We know a lot about, say, you know, Haitian Masons, but not necessarily the way groups of Black Freemasons might have connected. And so that's something I've, you know, coming across, you know, bits and pieces here studying Haiti, notably, that's something that's been very intriguing to me, and it remains intriguing. I don't know how far this is going to go, if this is going to be articles or a book, but that's one thing I'm looking into. And I have another project that's really, you know, just sort of brewing, and that is looking at fictions of countries without Black people, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And I don't mean, again, fictional countries, right? Visions of future America, visions of, you know, such and such place where, for different reasons, people of color have somehow disappeared. And so I, you know, we talk about TV, you know, I'm thinking, for example, Man in the High Castle. I don't know if you watched this at all. The novel is similar, right? The premise is the same. That's just one example among many, but that's another thing I've been very intrigued about. And then I have ideas about, but we'll see where that goes. You'll be the first to know if it goes anywhere.
Hey, no, and that's awesome. And go to your to go to your Freemasonry point. You know, I found out I had Dr. Vanessa Valadis on the program last year, and found out that, you know, Schomburg was a Freemason as well in New York. Wow. And so, you know, and if I'm not mistaken, you know, there's a group of Black Cubans as well and such in New York in the late 19th, early 20th century. Mm-hmm. So it's just like really in spaces and places that you don't necessarily know. Like I worked at Boston African American National Historic Site in the city of Boston, of course. And, you know, so you learn about Prince Hall Masonry, and I would on the bus go by the present day, you know, founding what they would call like a, I guess, one of the main, you know, Prince Hall spaces in the city of Boston or Roxbury. Mm-hmm. And so it's so like I would see it all the time. So it kind of just was, I guess, part of the scenery, part of the background. But to see it in other places to me is always interesting. So to hear about your work and the various projects that you have coming out, I'm like, well, my friend, I hope that you're getting a little bit of sleep. Hope you're drinking a little water, get a little exercise, because we definitely want to keep you healthy as you continue to do your work and rise from assistant professor to associate professor. Wow. So congratulations on that.
Thank you very much.
Very good. And yes. So, you know, and so, you know, once again, it has been a pleasure to have you on the program. And, you know, it's going to be it's just exciting to see your work. And it was exciting to actually meet you officially at the roundtable at the African-American Intellectual History Society's roundtable on The Common Wind from Julius Scott. Which was published mm-hmm. in the same year formerly as yours. And so, you know, great to actually get to meet you and, you know, say, hey, you know, I'd love to have you on the program. And clearly based upon us talking for over 56 minutes, it happened. Yes.
An amazing conference, by the way, AIHS. I would recommend it to anyone alive.
Yes, absolutely. And that, you know, the next conference is going to be, I believe, March 5th and 6th of 2020 at the University of Texas at Austin. So it's going to be in a warm weather place again. It was been in Boston and Ann Arbor, Michigan for the last couple of years. So now we're going to be warm in March. And hopefully, we don't know. Texas can turn real quick. We know it's might not be politically, but we know weather-wise, it's probably a better assumption of a change, shall we say? Until further notice, you know, 2020 might be that further notice, but that's another podcast. Yeah, man. So once again, thank you so much, folks. We've had the pleasure of having Associate Professor of English at the University of Connecticut at Stanford. Didn't put that in before. University of Connecticut at Stanford. The phenomenal Dr. Gregory Pierrot for his amazing, amazing new book published by our friends at the University of Georgia Press titled The Black Avenger in Atlantic Culture. And I'm your host, Adam McNeil. And once again, please come back, subscribe, show us some love, you know, rate us, review us on your various podcast platforms at which you consume the content. And we want to know how we're doing. We want to know how you're liking the content that we're bringing to bear for y'all to listen to. And so, once again, folks, I'm Adam McNeil from New Books in African American Studies. Over and out.
Thanks for